Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, coming to you from Miami, where I've been covering the Democratic presidential debates. And I'm joined today by Gatehouse Capitol correspondent John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hello, Zach. Hope you're enjoying the 305.
Yeah, it's been especially hot down here, even for South Florida standards, but that doesn't necessarily translate into a sizzling debate. The 10 Democrats who debated in the opening night of this two-day marathon kept things pretty civil. There weren't really any tough exchanges, but that doesn't mean there wasn't plenty of disagreement on things like policy, especially when it comes to bigger government. We'll dive into that and also talk about how Florida issues figured into the debate. But first, it's time to throw out some numbers here. John, what's your number this week?
Zach, I'm coming in with a pretty big number this week, 156,000.
156,000. Okay, well, you've got me beat. I'm only going to throw out a four this week. So that's John Kennedy with 156,000 and Zach Anderson with a four. Podcast listeners, remember, these numbers, we'll come back to them at the end of the show and explain what they mean in Florida politics. Well, the time is finally here, folks. Presidential debate season has begun, and Florida played host to the first in what will be a long series of matchups over the coming months. The first Democratic debate was notable for the divide among the candidates on issues such as health care, college affordability, taxes. This is a big theme in the Democratic Party this year, and something the party really has grappled with for a long time, how much to embrace big government programs like a national health insurance system. Elizabeth Warren was asked about this right off the bat Wednesday night, and the Massachusetts senator who is really on the left wing of her party, really gave a staunch defense of her position. She supports Medicare for all, free college tuition, breaking up the big tech companies, among other progressive priorities. And when she was asked whether these proposals could really disrupt the economy, she pushed back on that.
You have many plans, free college, free childcare, government health care, cancellation of student debt, new taxes, new regulations, the breakup of major corporations. But this comes at a time when 71% of Americans say the economy is doing well, including 60% of Democrats. What do you say to those who worry this kind of significant change could be risky to the economy?
So I think of it this way. Who is this economy really working for? It's doing great for a thinner and thinner slice at the top. It's doing great for giant
So there you have Warren really saying that, you know, the economy is not really working for everybody and that we need more aggressive government intervention. But not all the Democratic candidates agree with Warren and Bernie Sanders and some of the other more progressive candidates on these issues. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, for example, said she's not on board with free college tuition for everyone.
I do get concerned about paying for college for rich kids.
And during an exchange on health care, former Congressman John Delaney said he doesn't like the idea of having a single payer system like Medicare for All, where people would lose their private health insurance coverage.
I think we should be the party that keeps what's working and fixes what's broken. I mean, doesn't that make sense? I mean, we should give everyone in this country health care as a basic human right for free, full stop. But we should also give them the option to buy private insurance. Why do we have to stand for taking away something from people?
So you have this debate about sort of the role of government in the economy, especially. And New York Mayor Bill de Blasio interjected, and he said this is really kind of central to the primary race.
Let me tell you what we're hearing here already in the first round of questions is that battle for the heart and soul of our party. I want to make it clear. This is supposed to be the party of working people. Yes, we're supposed to be for 70% tax rate on the wealthy. Yes, we're supposed to be for free college, free public college for our young people. We are supposed to break up big corporations when they're not serving our democracy.
So there you have de Blasio defending higher taxes on the wealthy and other progressive priorities. You know, de Blasio, Warren, Sanders, they're all pulling the party to the left on these issues. And some of these candidates are resisting that leftward pull. Meanwhile, Republicans are trying to paint the Democrats as socialists. The head of the Republican National Committee, Ronna McDaniel, went to the Versailles restaurant in Little Havana, which is the heart of Cuban's exile community, yesterday. Really, that's a hotbed for anti-socialism sentiment in the country. And I caught up with her and was there for a press conference where she said that the Democratic Party is lurching to the left and embracing socialism.
You are seeing the Democrat Party embrace socialism, government takeover of health care, getting rid of private plans for hundreds of millions of Americans, 10 million just here in Florida that would lose their private plans. You're seeing them say, let's take over education. And what happened in Cuba is the same thing. The government took over. They took over lands. It was redistribution. It forced people to flee here to come find the American dream. And we are offering not just proposals. We're offering actual action and things that have taken place under this president with lower unemployment, with wages on the rise, with so many good things that are happening economically across this country for the Hispanic community, for all communities. So I think that it's a real contrast that we can offer to the voter.
So the Republicans are counter-programming here during the Democratic debate and really trying to slam the party for what they say is a socialist bent. This socialism critique is not really new. It's been leveled at Democrats for decades, really. Republicans are hoping, though, that maybe it peels off some support in the party in key states, especially Florida, where you have, you know, an influx of Latin American folks who have experienced socialist economic systems and have fled from those countries. So I asked de Blasio if a staunchly liberal candidate like himself can win Florida in the general election with this kind of dynamic swirling around socialism and some of these issues. Here's what he had to say.
Progressive coming to the state with a clear progressive economic message. I don't have a doubt in my mind. And next time, the turnout's going to be extraordinary here.
John Kennedy, de Blasio sounds pretty confident, but we've seen this debate play out in Florida, including in the most recent governor's race, which is what he was referring to. What did we learn from that race?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the heart and soul of the party fight is one that's going to linger. And we saw it unfolding now in Miami on a national stage. But when we saw it last year in Florida, you know, you hear so much of Florida being a microcosm of America, rich, poor, ethnic, you know, a service economy. And maybe that helps explain why the Democrats are here for their debate. But Florida is also a great place to beta test campaign themes, you know, when you just try out some things. And what the Democratic field is going through now, with Republicans blasting them as socialists for their ideas on healthcare and education, we saw it last year in our big races for governor and for U.S. Senate. You remember a Democratic gubernatorial nominee, Andrew Gillum. He also came out of a crowded field of primary candidates. That sounds familiar. He was labeled a socialist by Republican Ron DeSantis for his ideas about hiking the minimum wage, increasing the corporate income tax to fund education, and for expanding Medicaid coverage to 1 million more Floridians. Now, even Democratic U.S. Senator Bill Nelson, who's a popular image as an old school middle of the roader, he got labeled socialist by Republican Rick Scott, who used the terms very memorably. He used socialism or socialists a half dozen times at a Republican unity rally last September when the Republicans were kicking off their fall election season. So, you know, you got to wonder, does that kind of a socialist scare work in Florida? you know, both DeSantis and Scott won, although extremely narrowly, it does make you think that Florida, as a toss-up purple state in this presidential race, still has a stronger tinge of Republican red in it than Democratic blue. So especially when it comes to being ready to accept dramatic changes to the economy or more, you remember Florida, we like to think of ourselves as trendsetters, but we weren't way out front on marijuana access, same-sex marriage, and we are still among only a few states that haven't expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, that of course, is a product of the state being led by Republicans. But you do have to wonder what might change next year. Now, in Florida, the presidential contest will yield a much bigger turnout than the 63% who voted in the governor and Senate races last year. De Blasio noted that. And there's a good chance that there will be a ballot amendment to raise the state's minimum wage, something that also could be a motivator for a lot of lower income and working Floridians who, you know, they really may be ready for a change. The socialist attacks may not be as alarming to Florida voters who really do see some of the economic disparities in this state, which is so topped by many wealthy people, but also home to so many people who are struggling. So that working class message by Democrats, it is possible that that's a winning formula this time around in Florida.
It's interesting that you bring up Bill Nelson, too, because he's kind of the definition of sort of a more moderate, kind of old school Democrat establishment, not somebody who you would think of as a big socialist. And Rick Scott kind of criticized him anyway. And I think some Democrats think that, well, no matter what we do, they're going to criticize us as socialists, whether you're pushing moderate policies or more aggressive big government policies. So, you know, why not actually go for these policies? You know, that's sort of been the progressive argument. You know, they're going to attack us no matter what. Gillum kind of made that point during the primary. But I don't know. I think the issue does resonate a little bit in Florida, especially in South Florida and some of these Cuban and maybe some of the Venezuelan immigrants. And you have a lot of older voters in Florida who sort of lived through, you know, the Cold War or the period right after that and might be more concerned about some of these issues than younger voters who don't necessarily see it as a big of a problem. But we'll have to see what candidate emerges. But it seems likely that no matter what candidate emerges, the Republican Party and Trump are definitely going to be talking about socialism and big government. So it's a theme that I think we'll see throughout the campaign season here. So some pretty substantive debates, though, on policy. I mean, this is a big divide in the Democratic Party. But for many of the candidates, this also was really just a kind of a chance to introduce themselves to voters. This is a huge Democratic field, more than 20 candidates, and many voters probably don't know much about a lot of these individuals. I think a lot of voters also are eager to see this field really start to winnow down, and these first debates are kind of the start of that process. John, what do you think? I mean, do we start to see some winnowing here? Do you expect some of these candidates to start fading away?
I think we do. I think, you know, in the next month, maybe even, it's likely that money is going to dry up for some of these candidates after the performance on, you know, these two nights in Miami. You've got to wonder about the future of candidates like John Delaney, Jay Inslee, Tulsi Gabbard, you know, maybe even a Beto O'Rourke, who seemed to come out of the sort of a Texas Hold'em standoff with a fellow Lone Star stater, Julian Castro, who is hitting him hard on immigration and border crossings. You know, I think for some, these two nights in Miami could effectively be make or break. And maybe when you have more than 20 Democrats in a field, that it does need some early culling that allows voters to focus, the party to start to hone its get out the vote machinery, and then, you know, maybe also allows donors to feel more confident about putting money behind somebody. But I think we could see some people trimmed out of this contest once Miami is finished. It may be a little bit of a slow unfolding of these campaigns when it comes to when do they really run up the white flag. But I think, you know, by sometime late summer, it's going to show some evidence of getting a little bit thinner.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see, you know, for the candidates that don't really have breakout performances. You know, I think all the candidates, you know, were fine up there. You know, you didn't have anybody really choke or, you know, unable to articulate their points of view. But there weren't really many that really had what you would consider. I don't think anybody really had a real breakout performance. It's hard to do that with, you know, so little time on the stage. You know, a lot of them had less than, you know, very little time to really articulate their proposal. So I think you'll see some of their supporters start to wonder, you know, if you're not really breaking through, you know, why do we continue to give money to you? And I think that'll start to cull the field. These debates are pretty unwieldy with 10 candidates on the stage each night. So I think a lot of the voters are hoping that this culling process starts pretty soon. Well, another theme running through last night's debate was the Florida connection, you know, having the first primary debate here in the state. It was kind of a consolation prize. Some Democrats in Florida were trying to get the Democratic Party's convention in the state and kind of put down a stake here as a key battleground. But that didn't happen. Instead, you know, they got the first debate. So the debate being in Miami, the moderators touched on a number of issues that have particular resonance in Florida. They mentioned the Parkland shooting and discussing what to do about gun violence. They brought up Florida's susceptibility to climate change. The debate also targeted Hispanic voters, which is a key demographic in Florida. You saw a number of candidates speak in Spanish for extended periods. Really, Beto O'Rourke spoke Spanish for quite a bit. And you know, also the immigration issue is important here. You have a big detention center in Homestead that's been really controversial, and a lot of the candidates went and visited that. That's a place where unaccompanied minors who are apprehended at the border are taken to this facility. So, you know, the debate did have a little bit of a Florida focus. John, what are your thoughts on how Florida-centric this was?
Yeah, it really was. Florida was sort of the platform for issues that was, you know, became part of this debate. When as you mentioned, the climate change issue, immigration, you know, the economy on a larger scale, I guess. But the homage to Hispanic voters is something that three of the candidates managed to get some Spanish language commentary in there. And we'll probably see more of that in the second round of debates. It's just something that the Hispanic voters are a mixed bag in Florida. Not all are Democrats. Not all are that monolithic when it comes to their views of things like immigration and how well the state is doing and the nation is doing as an economic force. So some of it was Florida just seemed to be kind of the opportunity for questions. And we didn't really have answers that were Florida centric, but there were things like gun control issues that was something that moderator was able to bring up, the idea of, you know, we're not that far from Parkland, and that's where so much of the issue has galvanized. And out of that, there seemed to be among the Democrats something too about the millennial vote, that they are all very much focused on how that can tip the balance. And that gets into a lot of the questions too about where Democrats are willing to go as far as how big a government they want. The socialist themes are things that don't seem quite as alarming to younger voters than it does to you know, middle and older voters. So yeah, Florida was just there as a good stage set for this debate, but also was because we do have so many frontline issues, we were able to be the catalyst for a lot of the debate questions.
I would agree with that. I think it was more of a catalyst. You know, the candidates really are speaking to a national audience right now. And Florida isn't, you know, really an early primary state. So I think, you know, they're not really going to be focused too deeply on, you know, Florida specific issues, maybe once, if it's still competitive, once the Florida primary comes around. But this will probably be the biggest focus we see during this part of the primary, though, because, you know, with the Florida, you know, voting on March 17th, I think, you know, it's kind of in the middle of the primary states. So I don't know how much the candidates will be here. They typically focus on the early primary states and you know, like the Super Tuesday states and the four states that go early. So we might not see this collection of candidates, this big a group of candidates back here for a while, if ever. So, you know, whatever limited focus there was on Florida is probably going to be the most that we get for a while. Well, with that, we'll move on to our pick a number segment. John, can you tell me about your number?
Yeah, Zach, I had come in with $156,000, and that's in dollars. That's the annual salary of Cynthia Kelly, Governor Ron DeSantis's director of policy and budget, who is retiring now that just last Friday, the governor went ahead and signed the state's almost $91 billion budget for the year starting July 1st. Now, Kelly had served as the budget chief under former Governor Rick Scott. She'd been there since 2013, and she stuck around this year, kind of putting off her planned retirement to help the new guy out. You know, that was once DeSantis came in, there was a rapid turnaround when it came to you know, when he had to put out a budget early in January. She's worked for state government for 31 years, and she was a budget director in the House and Senate committees before joining the executive branch under Scott. But the job, which probably will continue to pay something around $156,000, it's now open. And budget director is a premier job in any administration, and replacing Kelly is going to be tough. But it also will probably be a hurry-up priority of DeSantis, because you got to remember the legislative session starts in early January, not March next year. And by the time committee weeks begin in Tallahassee in September, state agencies are expected to already have submitted their budget requests. So DeSantis is going to be submitting his full budget proposal to the legislature probably by late November. So whoever is going to replace Kelly is going to have to get work very fast. And right now, there doesn't seem to be a likely candidate, and the pool of people is pretty limited as far as who have that kind of institutional budget knowledge that Kelly had. So there's a top job in the DeSantis administration that is unfilled at the moment.
Way to sneak in a non-debate related item into this podcast, John. My number was four being the number of Democrats who didn't make it onto the debate stage last night or tonight. By the way, there's 20 Democrats who are who made the cut to be in these two debates, but there's actually 24 candidates who are running, which means four of them didn't make the cut, including Wayne Messam, the mayor of Miramar here in Florida. The most well-known candidate who didn't make the cut is probably Steve Bullock, who's the governor of Montana. But it just says something about this field of candidates that there's so many that you couldn't even fit them all on the stage when 20 was the cutoff. So again, I think this is just a huge field, and the process of culling them can't happen soon enough for a lot of voters who have a hard time kind of grasping who all these folks are. Well, that wraps up another edition of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production staff of Joseph Forzano, Thomas Cordy, and Adam Fish. And thanks to all of you for listening. We're out of here.